Welcome to Iteration, a podcast about programming, development, and design through the lens of amazing books, chapter by chapter. My name is John, and I am joined by JP.
How's it going?
It's going really good. Last week was RubyConf, at least in real time, and I spent a lot of this weekend kind of catching up on work and kind of just trying to breathe after RubyConf, which was awesome, by the way. It was so great to meet so many other great Rubyists and people, and you were there, JP, which was super cool.
Yeah, super cool. My favorite part about RubyConf is that the sponsors were actually like things that I'm like familiar with. And so the swag was very, very on point. For instance, I went to Scale this year and it's like the Linux conference. And there was just there were a bunch of like DevOps related sponsors there that I was like, I don't know what this is. And I don't know if these people are trying to sell to me, but I guess the logo is kind of cool. But at RubyConf, it was like Heroku and Twilio. And I was like, oh, I definitely use those things. They're relevant to my life. Not that I go to conferences just for swag. However, it does matter.
And your laptop ended up completely blasted in stickers by the end of the conference.
Yeah, I came back and all my coworkers are like, what did you do to your laptop?
It looks like a piece of garbage because it's so covered in stickers. But like there's this kind of aesthetic to it that's kind of cool. It's like a bathroom in a bad club in Hollywood.
Yes, that's exactly what I was going for. Whenever I want to take it off, I just want to peel it from one corner and it will like take off the whole thing.
Yeah, that's all part of being a web dev is getting into the stickers. I heard this 99PI, which is a great podcast episode all about coal miners and stickers on their helmets.
Oh.
And how coal miners, like they like trade in stickers and it's like very much a thing in their industry. Like the stickers you have on your helmets is like different mines you're in and different specialties that you like specialize in, like different types of equipment and stuff. And I'm like, dude, this is so how web developers are. Like we all have different stickers, whether you're front end or back end or, you know, what types of languages and frameworks. And like, it's definitely like a thing and no one wants to admit how much they like it, mm-hmm. but it's just kind of a part of the industry, which is kind of interesting. And it's interesting to hear about other industries that have like a similar thing.
Yeah. It's like your street cred basically.
Yeah, in a way.
It's funny. My coworker was like, do you even know what all these stickers are for? And they were like, I was like, yeah, of course I do. They're like, what's this one? I was like, oh, that's like a Sidekick one. That's a Heroku one. That's another Heroku one.
Yeah.
That's one of our open listing stickers. It's like, yeah, these are all very relevant. Like, oh, that's a RubyConf one.
There was a piece of getting the swag that I was like, well, at least finally these companies are giving me something. Like Heroku like gave me a hard time about giving me socks a little bit. They're like, oh, you have to fill out our form and like, do you use our product? And I was like, I pay you like $800 a month. Like, give me a freaking pair of socks. Like I was playful about it, but at the same time, I'm like, come on, give me the $5 socks so you can afford it. Trust me, I know based on my bill, you guys can afford it.
Yeah, I earned these socks. And while you're at it, throw in those playing cards in a t-shirt as well.
That's right. And if you don't believe me, like I'll show you my invoices on Heroku. It's so much money. All right. So this chapter, I am loving this book. So again, we're back to the Sandy Metz book, Practical Object-Oriented Design in Ruby, or Pooter, as it's kind of referred to and known as. And we're hopping into chapter 3 this time. And this chapter, and Sandy Metz herself, she says it's about, quote, getting access to behavior when that behavior is implemented in other objects. So it's all about managing dependencies and how to have models and objects talk to each other in a way that's maintainable and simple and understandable. And I got a ton out of this chapter and I'm excited to start tearing through it. So I'm not sure the best place to start. What are you thinking, JP?
I think a good place to start is this quote. There's just so many good quotable things and I don't want us to blabber on for too long without dropping some good nuggets. So I'm going to kick it off, if you will, with this quote.
Yeah.
It's basically just an intro to this chapter. It's quote, because well-designed objects have a single responsibility, their very nature requires that they collaborate to accomplish complex tasks. This collaboration is powerful and perilous. To collaborate, an object must know something about others. Knowing creates a dependency. If not managed carefully, these dependencies will strangle your application. End quote. And so this quote is basically talking about things we've talked about in the past where you have to sort of accept the fact that if you have a big application, it's going to be big. It's going to be complex. There's no silver bullet to writing the cleanest code and having like a really, really, really big application that scales really nicely. It has hundreds and thousands of users and the code is just going to be like dead simple. It's going to be complex, but you can do things to manage your dependencies and the way that objects talk to each other to make expanding and working on your application much, much nicer. So just about dependencies, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. And so Sandy defines when an object has a dependency for us, so we can kind of like get a good definition of that, so we can all be on the same page before we understand how to prevent and manage dependencies. Like, let's figure out what a dependency is. So an object has a dependency when it knows the name of another object. So if you have a class and it knows the name of another class, that's automatically a dependency. So that's one way. Another way is when a class knows the name of a message, or to say it another way, a method that it intends to send to another object. So it lives within a class and it knows the method of another class. So let's say you have a notification object and you have a user object. If you're calling notification send from your user object, your user has a dependency of the notification send method within the notification object. So in that case, like, that's a very coupled dependency to your user model to have that notification dependency within your user.
Yeah, totally. And so the tricky part about talking about all this stuff is that this book has really good code examples. So I think what we should try to do is actually talk about code instead of like theory, because we have this tendency to lean towards theoretical things that are loosely related to our jobs. So I think I want to go over the two classes that this book talks about. And I think it's like worth sort of like laying that foundation.
Yeah. So, and we kind of introduced it in earlier episodes, which is nice. So we kind of have a little bit of foundation there. But basically, we're back to this concept of modeling out a bicycle, but specifically the wheel and gear classes and how those interact with each other.
Yeah. So the two classes that we're going to be talking about are gear and wheel. So yeah, for the rest of the discussion, we will basically be talking in the context of those two things. And there's an example about how these two classes are coupled and ways to sort of make the way that they are coupled together easier to work with. So the first class is this like gear class, right? And I'm just going to describe it. So we have like an adder reader, which has a chain ring, a cog, a rim, and a tire method, right? And so when you initialize this class, you have to pass it a chain ring, a cog, a rim, and a tire. And so these arguments in the initialize method are just ordered arguments. It's not a hash. It's literally just four things. They could be, for all you know, you could be passing it like a string, an integer, an array, and a hash. But there's like no enforcement of what that is. Okay, and gear also has another method called gear inches. And gear inches will take a ratio, whatever that is, and multiply that by an instance of a wheel that takes in a rim, a tire, and then calls diameter on wheel. So what that looks like is ratio, which is another method that we're going to define, ratio times wheel.new rim, you pass in a rim and the tire that you're instantiating it with, and call diameter on that. Hopefully that was like, I was able to describe that well enough.
I think so. I'm purposely not looking at the code. Okay, at least cool. One of us isn't, so that I can kind of define things if we're not. So thinking about this code that we talked through, which isn't always the best thing, I just want to kind of like introduce some of the first problems that we can quickly see. So the first one, in a way, is a dependency, which is it's a method that accepts just open-ended data into it. So it requires four points of data into it. And you don't know what type of data necessarily it's being required to pass or what order to pass them in, just looking at the method. So that's one of the first issues with this that can be really sticky in trying to refactor. And in a way, just a specific order is kind of its own dependency in itself. So that's something to think about within that. But we'll talk more about that in a little bit when we talk about initialization. And then the other one here is that within a method of the gear class, we're calling wheel.new. So we're calling a new instance of the wheel object right within the gear method, within this specific chain inches method. And so that means that if we modify our wheel object at all, it's going to potentially break our behavior that's within that gear class. And so that's some of the two first issues we're seeing this here, which is really hard to deal with. Like, all this is so hitting home as far as when I've tried to refactor things and felt like I couldn't. This is oftentimes two areas that I really stumble on in Ruby, which is having those miscellaneous kind of params being thrown into a method and then just depending too deeply on nested dependencies within themselves.
Yeah, and there's also a couple more things that make this tightly coupled, right? So like when you're calling wheel.new and passing in the rim and the tire that you're passing in the gear, you're also depending on the fact that the API of wheel is going to take two ordered parameters, rim and tire. And then what's more is that you're depending on the fact that wheel will have a diameter method, whether it's an adder reader, an adder accessor, whether it's like just a method, like you're depending on the fact that it has diameter as well. So now the interface of wheel doesn't really matter too much. All you really need to know is that we have this gear class that has a bunch of stuff that it doesn't need to know about wheel. But, you know, it eventually will need to know about some of these things at some points. But the point is that we can like encapsulate some of wheel's API into like a single method. That way, if those things were to change, you know, you just have to change them in one spot and not like look for every instance of wheel.new and then like edit all of the parameters that you're sending in. But yeah, so that was just like what we're looking at as a base.
Yeah. To reiterate, one of the issues, like you had mentioned, that there's not only ordered params that are being passed in the first method, but the method within that method also has ordered params that are being passed to it. So it's like you have this double layer where things could get out of order and having to know, okay, is that the first index, the second index? Like where specifically are these things at and that ordering within it? So what is one of the first recommendations, knowing some of the problems with this code, what are some of the easy places to start to tease these objects apart from each other?
Cool. Yeah. So this book recommends like 4-ish ways that you can improve this code. And so the first thing we're going to talk about is dependency injection, which is this crazy thing that you might have heard of. Like, I don't know. I feel like in circles, at least when you're new to programming, you hear dependency injection and it just sounds like some crazy thing. But all it's doing is literally what it sounds like. You're injecting dependencies, which is like very circular of a way to explain it, but we'll get into that. So this is what the problem is. Gear inches hard codes a reference to wheel, right? And so you have wheel deep inside of this method on the gear. Gear doesn't like, it doesn't really care that it's a wheel. All it should know is that it multiplies ratio times some kind of diameter. What if we wanted to pass in a boulder that for some reason has like a diameter as well, right? Like all it needs to know is it needs to multiply ratio by something. So like you can get like an easy win by, you know, taking one step at a time, not like just ripping out all of your code and like replacing it basically.
That's a great point. Like start small, do something small, just pull something out.
Yeah, what you can do is instead of calling wheel.new, passing in rim and tire, and then calling diameter on it, is you can call wheel.diameter. And then in your initialize method, instead of passing in all of the stuff that you're passing down to wheel, you could just pass down like a reference to like wheel. So it would look like gear.new, you would pass in the chain ring, you would pass in the cog, but instead of passing in rim and tire, you would just pass in wheel, right? And then so you can do like gear.new, a number, and then pass in wheel.new, and then whatever the parameters are for that initialized method, and then call gear inches, which sounds terrible as I like speak it out loud, but hopefully that's like somewhat easy to follow.
So I'm going to say it another way because you're looking at the code and I'm not, and you even lost me and I read it a little bit there.
Okay, cool.
One of the things here is the high level recommendation that I took away from this first tip of dependency injection is instead of instantiating a new other referenced object within your model, rewrite your model so that you can pass an instantiated object within it when you call it. So that means that instead of calling gear.new and the params within it, you can call gear.new. Then within your params, you could call wheel.new within the params of that wheel call. And that's tearing out the new object instantiation within gear into the place you're actually using it in your interface. So it's redefining your interface of the class just a little bit so that instead of the class creating the new object, you create the new object when you call it. Is that right? Or am I talking about something different?
You are, but I just realized like the sides have like flipped and now I am now realizing how hard this is. Okay, let's take a step back. Let's talk about dependency injection like at a very
at a high level
like in a general case. Okay, so like when you have a method in a class that doesn't pass in any parameters, right? So it's just a method that takes zero arguments. I think I keep
user.firstname.
Sure. Yeah, I keep conflating arguments and parameters, whatever.
Yeah, I do too. We should be saying arguments in this case.
Yeah, so, okay. Yeah. So let's say you have something like, let's just talk about like the idea of like a pure function and like a function that mutates things, right? Because inherently you have, sure. you deal with dependency injection there, right? So mm-hmm. like in gear inches, okay, so we're calling wheel.new. But like if you wanted to just like inject this dependency directly in, what you can do is you can make gear inches have an argument that passes in wheel, right? And then that wheel will call dot diameter on it, right? So you don't have to have a wheel.new pass in a bunch of this other stuff and then call diameter on that. You can just pass in a reference as the first argument to gear inches. That way, when you call gear inches, you pass in whatever. It doesn't have to be a wheel. It could just be anything that responds to the diameter message. And then right there, you have already done this idea of injecting your dependencies. All dependency injection is making sure that like every time, I don't know, I don't want to conflate the idea of like a pure function and a function that like mutates code, but because I guess you can make an argument. I guess there's an argument for like dependency injection doesn't necessarily guarantee like pure functions. I don't know, maybe it does. It's hard to talk about this and like say things. I don't want to be saying things that are incorrect. However, passing in arguments, like abstracting out things that are like highly coupled by passing in them as an argument is a way to like decouple your code. Hopefully that makes more sense.
That part of it was well said. Absolutely. What was some of the other tips of good ways to decouple the code? So the first one being dependency injection, which we got a pretty good overview of. What was the next one in the chapter?
Okay. So another way that we can improve this code is by isolating dependencies. And so when you can't use dependency injection, it's possible to isolate your dependencies instead. So for example, in the case where we have this idea where we call diameter against a wheel, let's say for whatever reason, we don't have access to the API where we can just like, for whatever reason, we can't change the initialize method or like the signature of it. Let's say that's too big of a step, right? Like, because if we change the initialize method of our gear class, it's going to totally fuck shit up and we're going to have to change 100 other files. And, you know, sometimes find and replace when you're finding and replacing across like more than 3 files, it feels kind of like, I don't know if I should be doing this. And large applications are large, you know, things like that. But you're still like, but I don't really want to call wheel.new, pass in 2 arguments, and then call diameter on that inside of my gear inches method. Like, what can I do? I still want to call just a wheel.diameter. Like, I know I want to pass diameter to this idea of a wheel. What you can do is you can isolate this idea of a wheel. And the way that you can do that is you can create a method called wheel and then have an instance variable where you're setting like wheel, like at wheel, the instance variable wheel to the new instantiation of that wheel object. So you can, inside the gear inches like interface, all you're doing is calling ratio times wheel.diameter, but the wheel is hidden behind its own interface. You're abstracting and encapsulating that knowledge of what wheel is into its own method. So wheel could just be anything, right? As long as it can respond to diameter. It could literally just be like anything. It doesn't have to be a wheel.new. It could be tire.new.
Anything can accept a diameter method on it can be passed into there. Or yes. Gear inches method in this specific example.
Yes, 100%.
Yeah. No, and I love that idea because it extracts it outside and it makes the code more reusable, because before we could only call that method on a wheel, but now because of the way that we refactored this, we have the flexibility of passing the gear different things beyond a wheel. Like, what if we wanted to make an electrified e-bike in this example? Like, there might be a motor class that has its own diameter or chain inches that is not quite the same as a gear because it has different behavior from a gear, but we still want it to be able to interact with a wheel and a gear, the motor. And so this is a good example that because applications change, it's important to isolate that dependency, create a method, like encapsulate the knowledge of the specifics of the wheel into its own method so that you can pass something else beyond a wheel into it. It's hard to describe the nuance within that, but hopefully this gets your brain thinking of ways that you have interdependencies and ways that you can isolate them and general terms that you can maybe Google and when you're sitting down to refactor ways to think about it. So that's kind of my goal in the conversation. It's not like I can give you the exact line by line way to refactor it because it's an audio example, but hopefully we can kind of get your brain working in those directions.
Yeah, and let's take it even a step further. So let's think about how far we've come. Let's say we've done a little bit of refactoring. Our gear inches method now looks like ratio times wheel dot diameter. So to us, at this point in time, we don't really care what wheel is. Wheel is in some other method, and maybe we're even doing some other crazy mutations on it. Hell, well, we're doing like an active record query where wheel is actually grabbing a wheel from a database, right?
Sure.
Like, yeah. It really doesn't matter. But we still have another dependency here. We're calling ratio times wheel dot diameter. And so this chapter talks about when you send messages sent to someone other than self. Right, because right now ratio is a message sent to self because it's on gear. We have a ratio method. So ratio is being sent to self. Wheel is also being sent to self now, right? Because wheel is a method on gear. But diameter is being sent to wheel. So now we have a message sent to something that's not self. And this was like a concept that was like a little weird to read to me at first. I was like, what the heck does this even mean? Messages sent to someone other than self. And I swear it didn't like really even make sense to me until maybe like this time reading this book. Because I've read this book like three times now and it's only been like, oh, that's what they mean. But anyways, diameter is sent to the instance of wheel. So we can even take this a step further and refactor this method to just be ratio times diameter. And then diameter could be its own method that encapsulates all of that logic again. So obviously this is like a contrived example and it just feels like we're making small code even smaller. But I think the thing to note here is that when you have these dependencies, it's possible to encapsulate the knowledge that these objects have of each other into their own methods so that like should things change, you only have to change them in like one spot and not, you don't have to like chase things down everywhere.
Yeah. I think the other advantage into breaking up code like this into smaller encapsulated methods is that it's self-documenting because it's so much easier to understand what's going on with each of these methods. It's, to me, it's always useful. I mean, of course, there's a spectrum of everything, but it's usually useful to break a complex method down into simpler methods. So as much as you can do that, it's definitely worth the overhead of taking the couple minutes to do that. It makes it not only more self-documenting, but it makes it much more maintainable and starts to encapsulate some of this stuff like we've talked about.
Yeah. As a digression, I was going over some code review with one of our, he's not really a new hire. He's been here for like 6 weeks now at Open Listings, and he's not really familiar with like Rails land. And so in his code, I helped him refactor to use like scopes, and because he wasn't like aware that you can like have scopes in your model if you're doing like a query. Mm. So like instead of doing a query everywhere in your code, you can encapsulate all of that knowledge in a scope. So like, let's say we have a scope for, let's say we have like a wheel model in a theoretical Rails application.
Yeah.
And sure. And you want to query all wheels where the diameter is greater than 52 inches.
Or all wheels that are inflated.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, there you go. All wheels that are inflated, they're not, where not flat and yeah. diameter is greater than some number. Yeah. So basically what he was doing was he was having this like query it was only in like two places, right? But it was sure. a long enough query that it was like, oh, that's like repeated code. And it feels weird to have this specific use case literally repeated twice in the same file within like 10 lines of each other. And I was like, oh, we can just put that in scope. And he was like, oh, what's a scope? And then I had to explain to him like what the benefits of that are, because I don't know, I don't like to tell people to like, hey, you should change your code without giving them like a good reason as to sure. like why I think you should be doing that. And also like what the benefit is. And what the benefit of that is that now that you have, let's say we have this scope called, I don't know, all inflated 52. So it's like all inflated tires that are would have a diameter of 52 inches. Now you have this like encapsulated logic of inside of the scope where if you want to change what that logic is, all you have to do is go to that scope and change it. Like it doesn't matter what the internals are, it's just that we have like a nice interface for this query.
Yeah, it's a really good example of dry code and keeping code changeable, because oftentimes I've used queries within methods instead of defining a scope. And then I remember to change it in one place, but I don't remember to change it in the other. And so then like it ends up redefining some permissions possibly, or what someone should and shouldn't see. Like, for example, within the WizTutor application that we've talked about a lot, we used to have, you know, a concept of like what tutoring sessions are active, meaning they're in the future, they're not scheduled, they're paid and confirmed, what that scope looks like. And for a long time, that wasn't a scope. It was a defined query. And I remember at one time I had to update what that included. So we wanted to include not only things that are in the future, but also 24 hours past to allow people to have 24 hours to enter the information if they haven't done so. And I didn't update it in all the views. So one side could see them 24 hours past, but the other couldn't. And so finally, at some point when I refactored that, all those tutoring sessions, that query got refactored into an active scope. So it's super easy to go tutoring sessions.active. And again, breaking down those queries is again, self-documenting in a way that is like totally makes sense. Like, oh, tutoring sessions.active. I know exactly what's going on here in this code, and it's encapsulated into its own place.
Yeah, totally. Imagine like a new developer coming onto a project and not having that scope, and them having to like grep the code base for like user.where, and then looking at all the queries where user.where exists, and then trying to figure out which ones are like supposed to be the like active ones.
Yeah,
be like a nightmare.
Absolutely. Yeah. So going back to our wheel and gear kind of class and interdependency discussion, there was something that we still haven't really talked about, which is the issue of the ordered arguments within the initialization. And so Sandy recommends to use hashes for initialization arguments. And this is something that I do somewhat inconsistently. I feel like if there's more than two arguments, I start reaching for hashes. But I think I'm going to start doing it no matter what, because she makes such a great case for making sure when you do that initialization, you have those hashes. So this is the quote that she says about using hashes for initialization. And just to like quickly pseudocode, that's basically instead of in your initialize method, just passing in those arguments as strings or integers or whatever they are, it's actually breaking them out with keys, with little hash symbols that define what those keys are. So in this case, you would have like a ratio and a diameter passed within that hash. But one of the reasons she gives, and this is a quote from the book, she says, you want to use hashes for initialization arguments, quote, gear is now free to add or remove initialization arguments and defaults, secure in the knowledge that no change will have side effects in other code, end quote. So the idea is that you can initialize this, you can add methods to it, remove methods from it, not remove, but you can augment or change these initialization methods without having to think through what the order looks like. And again, back to the argument of it's so much more self-documenting to know exactly what all the arguments being passed into the method are. And this is a takeaway for me. It's like definitely more than one argument every single time to me is going to be a hash. The little bit of cost setting that up on the front end is so much benefit on the back end.
Yeah. And so there's like cool things you can do with this too, is like setting defaults. So like, let's say you don't pass in a chain ring to your gear initialization. You can do something like the instance variable chain ring equals arguments dot fetch chain ring, which will, if you pass in chain ring, will return you that value, or like comma 40. So like arguments dot fetch chain ring comma 40. So like if there's no chain ring, I want the value 40. So it's like a cool little Ruby thing you can do to like have a default variable instead of doing something like the argument pipe as like an or some value, because you can potentially have like some truthy stuff. So like if you pass in false, it might have some potential downsides. What do you think about named arguments instead of using hashes for initialization?
I don't know the distinction, like what that looks like in the actual syntax.
Oh, is that the same thing? No, it's different. So for example, we have an initialize method that has args. Like it just has one thing it's being passed to. So args is a hash, right? And so you're taking keys off of args so that you can set the values to the instance variables.
Yeah. I don't use either one consistently. I know which direction we go with that, which is like, yeah, basically you have that args hash and then you can add different attributes to the args hash within the method when you're calling it or defining it more specifically. Yeah. Or the idea of explicitly defining out the different hash arguments and have those keys to the hashes right within the method. To me, they're like very closely related, and I wouldn't necessarily know the nuance of pros and cons. And I feel like I've used them somewhat interchangeably in my mind, but I would probably reach for straight up hashes within the initialization block within the method, probably first, even after reading this, and where that's going to be fresh in my mind, probably because to me, it's a little bit, just a tiny bit more friendly to the syntax of how it's called, because there isn't this args blocks that I then need to figure out what the args block is. Mm-hmm. I have the hashes right there in the initialization, but I wonder if there's any technical difference in the two or benefits or cons to either one of those directions.
Well, if you have like a named parameter, you can like ensure that you're passing in a chain ring or a cog, because like your thing will explode if you don't pass it in. So right. I guess it's like, it doesn't necessarily, I don't know if it does remove or argument order dependencies. I mean, it is just a hash. So I can see that it probably would remove the like argument order thing. It would just like ensure not type safety, but it would ensure that you're passing in the arguments that it expects.
Yeah, I don't remember off the top of my head, because I feel like if I have an args block, I can leave one blank and it still runs. Are you saying they're all required depending on your syntax?
Yeah, so you can make sure that things get passed in, but you can also like set defaults in the hash.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah,
it's a little bit of a tangent, I think.
What do you tend to reach for?
In the open listings code base, I've been like, I used to be all about the whole like just pass in a hash. Yeah. But now I'm sort of like leaning on like named
args block.
Yeah, named arguments.
Okay. Yeah.
I wish I could do like some live coding right now just to like see the difference.
Well, either one of those, regardless of the nuance of the syntax, is far better than just ordered arguments. Like far, far better, either one of those directions. And I think the nuance there and distinction might be whether or not you want them required or have defaults and what syntax you're comfortable with in either of those directions.
Totally. Yeah.
And so talking more about dependencies, that's really what this chapter is about. Sandy introduced this whole idea of kind of picking the right dependency direction. And this isn't something that I've thought about all that much outside of initial domain design. Like, okay, what should belong to what and what should have many of something, what that dependency direction is. But this is outside of your database structure. This is more of when you have items that must talk to, so we have objects that must talk to other objects, which one should talk to which? And it's interesting because she flipped this whole example. She was talking about the gear talking to the wheel. And then she rewrote all the code to have the wheel talk to the gear. And then I realized in almost every instance of an object that depends on an object, you could just flip the relationship and it would work in similar ways. And she talks about some pros and cons of dependency direction. So to like give another example back to like user notifications, so like within the user class calling the notification object, you could do it the other way, have the notification call the user object. And so there's lots and lots of different examples where you might have these interdependent enmeshed dependencies like this. And she talks about this direction. And the general guide that she gives is depend on things that change less often than you do, which is a really simple way of kind of remembering you should probably be depending on the thing that's more reliable. And to be completely honest, in most of my code bases, I think it's flipped for me because oftentimes I put the dependency where it's convenient. So that'll be in my objects that I'm always in. Like it'll be my user object or my message object. I tend to introduce other dependencies in those objects because like I'm already there and that's where my brain is thinking about it. It's like, oh yeah, I want to reference this user's most recent discussion post. I'll just call that on the user object, go discussion post.last, and then I'll get their most recent discussion post from the user object. I don't generally think about calling it the other way, like from my discussions model, passing the user or that other way, which according to what she's saying in a way, I'm not sure which is wrong or right. And I kind of want to talk through this and what you got out of it, JP.
No, yeah, totally. I had to do a little bit more reading outside of the context or think about this outside of the context of a gear and a wheel.
Yeah.
Because it's hard. Okay, this is where like the whole gear and wheel thing kind of break down for me is because like what should be talking to the other? It's not really a clear thing because there isn't ever like an app where you need to build a theoretical bicycle, right?
Well, and there's a less clear hierarchy between a wheel and a gear, like which is more important. We're like a cup and a pitcher, or let's say like, you know, a carton and an egg, like the egg goes in the carton. Like there's some things that like they insist on their own hierarchy.
Yeah, certainly. So I want to go back to what you were talking about of like a user and a notification, right? So let's go through the example of like, I want to grab a user's last notification. What you were saying is what you would tend to do in your code bases is do something like you would have the instance of a user and you would probably do something like user.notifications.last or something like that.
Yep,
right?
Absolutely.
But what this is suggesting is that a user doesn't necessarily need to, a user can exist without the notification, but it doesn't really make sense that a notification would exist without a user, right? Like it needs, the notification
that's
needs.
That's a good way to say it.
It like needs the, it can't exist, right? Like it needs to be associated to a user. So what this is suggesting is to, instead of doing something like user.notification, or like let's say it's user.getLastNotification. Let's say we scoped it, we had some kind of scope like that. What this is saying is that we should be reversing that direction of dependency. So maybe you, instead, what you do is you do like on the notification model, you can pass in a user and then grab its last notification. So maybe it's like notification.getLast and then pass in the user as an argument, and then that would spit out the user's last notification, which is kind of weird to me, but that's like what I understood as like being the reversal of dependency.
Yeah.
Not sure how that would work out in practice, though, actually, now that I'm speaking out loud about it.
Yeah, and I think that that example may not be the best example ever, but I think it's good, really good, and I will think through in the future when I'm putting a dependency into another model to think about the reverse for a moment. Like, consider it, should this be flipped? Should this be going the other way? And I think it's important because oftentimes I'll create dependencies within a model without necessarily giving a second thought. Like, oh, I need that, so I'll just kind of reference it from here. But I will find, I think that I will try to practice stopping and thinking about the opposite relationship just for a moment. Consider it. And it's like, does that feel more comfortable? Because I think in the notification use case, it feels more comfortable to call the notification from the user in my mind. But I could also see myself being in the notification class, trying to get the last user notification, realizing this may not be the easiest way to approach this. Or possibly not even calling the right dependency. Like, am I trying to get a dependency through a dependency when I could be accessing it directly? Like, what's the best way to approach that relationship? And I think this whole idea of depending on things that change less often than you do, like that's how she phrases the recommendation. To me, it's not super clear. Like, what does she mean by change? Like access or modified? Because in that case, then my notification is probably modified less often than my user. Possibly. My user object is always getting modifications and extensions, so then that relationship would be the right direction. But in other cases, it might not be so easy. You know, it might not be so clear. So I think it's important to just like consider the dependency direction and consider the opposite for a moment before just blindly adding it.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So I just thought how you would do this. Like, let's say you did want to reverse this dependency, right? Like you, for some reason, did not want to do it. What you could do is you could pass in like a reference to the ID, and then you could do like notification where user ID is the ID that you passed in, right? And then like created order by like -1, created at -1, and then grab like the first one or like grab that one. So you could theoretically grab like the most recent notification that way by like querying off of the user's ID and getting the most recent one just in like raw SQL, right? Now, I don't know. Yeah. Like what is better? Is it better to do it that way, or is it better to do it as like a user.notifications.last?
Yeah. To me, the takeaway is really consider the dependency direction, which is not something that I've thought a lot about before, at least in my classes. And this is a quote that she has on this idea. Quote, think of every dependency as an alien bacterium that's trying to infect your class. Give your class a vigorous immune system, quarantine each dependency, unquote. And that's just a good general quote covering kind of this whole idea of considering the dependencies that you're introducing into classes. And then within that, there's the nuance of consider the direction of those dependencies, which is really, really helpful.
Yeah, totally. Just something to be aware about. In practice, I don't know that I have any like good takeaways of like, yeah, always do this. But I think depend on things that change less often, I think is like a good rule of thumb. I don't know. What do you think? What's your takeaway on this last point of like dependency direction?
Yeah, I think it's a hard one and it's more nuanced than the others. Like to me, it's so clear to name your arguments in a method. It's so clear to not call an object within an object. Like, and there's clear ways to avoid that with dependency injection or isolating those dependencies. So I would agree that this last tip is a little bit less clear. Although I think it's useful to be just generally aware of your dependency direction and allow yourself to stop and consider, what if I flip this? And to realize that we have the flexibility to reverse those relationships. Like, it's really cool that we have that ability, and it might be the better way to go about it. And it's really hard to come up with a good example of this without contriving something, unfortunately.
Yeah, seriously. I think my biggest takeaway now is that now that I'm aware, I will try to make sure that I don't have like bi-directional dependencies, right? Like, so if I'm going in one direction, like with two different models, it better be just that direction, because like, then all of a sudden, if things change, you have like bi-directional dependency direction. I don't know. And so yeah, I feel that would be a case where it'd be like, oh, that's terrible.
Try to stay pretty much consistent in one direction. Like, is this a child of this? And that makes way more sense. And that's a good general tip overall. Cool. Awesome chapter. I'm excited to jump into chapter 4. Do you have any picks this week, JP?
Yeah, I have this article about like, I don't know. I just, you know how Google is like getting a lot smarter about things. So if you open up like a new tab, it will like recommend.
I get the best recommendations in my new tab. Like now, like my go-to when I have a moment of downtime is just the new tab Chrome page. Like there's such good articles and recommendations all the time.
Yeah, that should be my pick. But my pick is actually this article that I clicked, and it was something about like writing bad tests. And maybe we'll leave a link down below, but it was not writing bad tests, but it was basically talking about how when you're writing tests, you don't necessarily have to follow all of the principles of writing, quote unquote, good, clean, dry code in your tests. For the sake of like, because that's how you learned how to write, quote unquote, good code. Like sometimes it's okay to be a little bit repetitive, because the reason I picked this is because I was feeling this in like my own personal work when I was writing a capybara test or I was trying to grok through a failing capybara test, and all of the methods were abstracted into like other things, and it made actually hunting this bug down a lot harder, just like understanding it. And I know I've said in so many other cases that like, oh, it's so good to have everything abstracted and really small methods and this and that. But like sometimes when you're in a test, you just want to read it from the top down. I don't care if it's like a 50 line capybara test. Like sometimes just having just that is like a step-by-step direction. It's very imperative. Like sometimes I want my test to be imperative so that I can just read it top to bottom, know exactly what's going on. And that's that. Now, that's not to say that you can't like abstract things. However, there is like a certain degree to which you should do it. And I think like every decision you make as a programmer should be for your own benefit. So like if it's hurting you to like make tons of abstractions, maybe don't do that. That's basically what that's like what I took away from this article, which I thought was kind of cool.
Yeah, that is a good tip. I think that every test you read should really tell that story. And if you put too much in your setup, too much in your teardown, or you're abstracting it too much into a single method that does 8 steps, it's really hard to just go line by line and understand what's going on in that test. And then it's really hard to debug and like, where do I even put the binding pry in this?
Or like, right. Yes. Oh God, like, that's exactly
what's
going
on. Yeah. It's so frustrating to do that. So that's a good tip. Cool. And we'll drop that link for sure in the show notes to that article. Awesome. My pick this week it's been such a lifesaver. I've been using it for a week and I'm so impressed with this little app. So it's a Mac menu bar app. And it's called Crisp with a K, K-R-I-S-P, and it's crisp.ai, and it's free right now. And I guess it's somehow powered by NVIDIA AI. What it does is it interrupts your Mac's inputs and outputs, and it's like noise canceling for your Mac. And it's so fucking cool. It works so good. So like I have an office here in my home office that's like up in a loft, and I don't have a door that closes. So sometimes like my wife will be doing the dishes or watching Netflix or like in her room, and I'm like, have to be like, okay, babe, like I'm starting to call, like maybe like be quiet, and it's kind of annoying. So what this app does is it uses somehow machine learning and AI, but it does it locally on your machine, and it knows what a human voice is, and it's able to filter out background noise so incredibly well. And like, I didn't believe their little demos on their website, because like there's one where this guy's like on the Skype call and there's a baby crying and it's so loud in the background, and like they turn it on like on their website and it's like you can't hear any baby and he's flawless. Like, and they have a bunch of demos on the website of coffee shops and movies in the background and like all types of those common problems. And every single one is exactly right. Like, it's so crazy because I do this thing where constantly all day long, I use that tool Loom, which we picked in the past to record screencasts for like other developers and people on my team. So I record them constantly. And oftentimes these screencasts would have like Netflix going on in the background, my wife, you know, a day off work or, you know, dishes or the vacuum cleaner. And like, I'm always so impressed when I play them back in the last week when I know there was something noisy, like an ambulance driving by, and it was like deafeningly loud to me, and it's not at all on the mic. It's crazy. Wow. It's so impressive how good it is at blocking out background noise. I will say it adds like a little bit of grain to your voice, like a telephone overall. So I would never use it for the podcast because of that. But like for a conference call, like it's incredible. So like, and the other last tip I'll give about it is you can also put it on the person you're listening to. So like you can listen without background noise.
And what? That's crazy.
And this part's like the best part of the pick is that I have a lot of clients that refuse to use a headset on conference calls and they have a microphone that's different than their speakers. So when I'm talking, I hear my own voice delayed by 5 seconds and it drives me absolutely fucking insane because I'm like trying to speak and I'm hearing my own voice like looped back. Do you know what I'm talking about? It's such like a remote worker's problem. So if I turn that dial on, my repeating voice is background noise and it's totally ignored. So it's like, it's such like a sanity save and it's so nice. Cause I would actually find myself muting the other party while I talked. So I didn't have to deal with that. But this app like totally strips it out because the little bit of looping is just filtered out as background noise. I can't believe how good it works. It's so cool.
Wow, that sounds really cool. And it like can tell the difference between like a TV, like a movie, like someone speaking in a movie versus like someone actually speaking.
Yeah, it knows the difference between those. And it's like, it's really nuanced and good. Like I even like when I first got it, I was like, does this really work? Like before I went on a call and I like blasted music in my office and was talking and recording just in a QuickTime and I couldn't hear it at all. It's completely gone. It's so impressive. Yeah, it's really cool. I guess it uses the same technology like airline pilots and airlines have been using for that noise cancellation like kind of idea. But it's just worked really well. And it's totally a pain point for me, especially that my own voice looping back to me. It's always such a challenge on different client calls. And like, I can't make the client like go get a headset. Like I can't make them do that. So to some degree, it's just been such a lifesaver. So I had to make it a pick.
Sweet. Okay, that's an awesome pick. I think that about wraps it up. Next week, we are going to be talking about creating flexible interfaces. So that should be exciting.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for listening. And we'll talk to you guys next week. Peace out.
Peace.